I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So, Wall Street giants are toppling. What does that mean for your investments? We'll get some personal investment advice. But we start today with a conversation with someone who appears on the business pages. David Carr writes the Media Equation column for the New York Times. And, oh yes, he's also written now about his years as a crackhead. David's new book is The Night of the Gun. A reporter investigates the darkest story of his life, his own. And David joins us here in the studios. Welcome.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Now that we have their attention. I mean, we want to talk about the gun, the freebasing, the shooting up, the babies for whom you got straight. But not before leaving them in the car in winter to get one more hit, you know, in a crack house. Just a
true story.
Compelling story. But first, you couldn't script this business story that we're watching unfold this week. It just, you know, through the lens of your column, the media lens, how are you seeing this?
These are very gigantic dominoes that are falling. And what I was speaking with my wife this morning, and she said, well, is this the bottom? Is this the bottom? And that's the story everyone wants to know. Is it over yet? Everybody just wants to plug their ears and be told everything is fine. It looks like everything is not fine.
Well, David Carr, I guess we should talk about your story. And as part of that, I just want to ask, your voice, which is compelling, seems a little raspy. Is that in part because of another part of your story, which we haven't even mentioned, the cancer?
Yeah, I took a lot of radiation. I think it was compounded by tobacco, but my voice, which has been compared to something that was dragged behind a pickup for 100 miles, has a few more miles on it right now.
Well, the cancer came after your, I don't want to say recovery because I know an addict wouldn't, but you're addressing your crack cocaine story. Let's talk about that. I have to say, after reading the book, you sort of, while reading it, say the same thing that you would occasionally say about yourself. What a, let's see if a word I can use here. What a jerk. You know, what a guy who had everything going for him and threw it away. I mean, you very much address yourself this way in the book.
Yeah, this is not a story about a victim, about a guy who got slipped a Mickey by somebody. I was a person who had to walk a long ways to find trouble, and I did. And I had this baked-in desire to use mood-altering chemicals that I took to an extreme that I think a lot of people would have a trouble fathoming. Became something of an autodidact where even though I was a decent reporter and came from a loving family, where it ended up being pretty much the only thing I did.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like there are a couple other elements that put you here in this chair and not, you know, 6 feet under or forgotten in a jail. One was that you did all of this, the crack cocaine and the running around and hitting girlfriends, selling drugs, getting DUIs. You did it all, A, in Minnesota, where you had some friends in the police department because you've been reporting on them, but also there was a safety net. And also you did it as a white man. I mean, as reading this, I was thinking of, you know, some of the drug parties with the guys that you hung out with and, you know, all these white guys. I was thinking if you were African-American, well, you'd be deep inside some prison right now.
As I say in the book, I think that luck had a lot to do with what happened with me. And I think my racial identity played a significant role in my recovery. And by that, I mean, when I got in trouble, I had access to good counsel. I was dealing in powdered cocaine, not crack cocaine. And there is a baked-in sort of bias in the judicial system because crack cocaine is treated differently.
When you mean dealing, you mean selling. You're selling powdered.
Yes. Yeah. Whereas, and I mean, I did pick up one felony, but if that had been crack cocaine, I had been a black, you're right, this interview would be taking place from inside a federal prison, if at all. 11 misdemeanors, many of which I skated on. It's not that I lived a life beyond consequence. I did get in trouble. This did cost me sanity and health, and in some cases, my freedom, but I always went to jail. I never went to prison, and there's a real big difference.
Right. Do me a favor. I've been sort of glossing over some of the things you participated in. Would you mind doing a laundry list for me, just what drugs you used, what things you did?
I was a very typical adolescent, and the first drug I used was nicotine. I think people underestimate tobacco is a gateway drug to other things that put me proximal to people who smoked marijuana, and they took acid, and then so did I, meaning LSD. Through college, I was your typical sort of party boy garbage, had a lot of beer, a lot of marijuana, a lot of LSD. On my 21st birthday, I tried cocaine, and many people, I think, tried cocaine and sort of said, wow, what was that about? Got a sense of its lurid ambush and walked away. I, on the other hand, had kind of a Proustian moment of, well, this is it. There was this and only this. And so even though through most of my 20s, I did remain employed and work hard as a reporter at night, I started running with people who were very involved in the drug lifestyle and support my habit. I eventually got involved in dealing, and I, along the way, bumped into Anna, who had an unlimited supply of cocaine right from the Medellin cartel. I found her unbelievably attractive for some reason, and we would have come and gone in each other's life very quickly, except she ended up pregnant, and she had the twins 2.5 months premature.
Well, you guys were lighting up when her water broke.
Yes, that's something Anna continues to deny, but that's part of what the book's about, is how the truth sort of lies between people. I did at least 60 interviews, many of them videotaped, pulled 400 pages of documents, and I was able to show Anna the documents, you know, the admit documents from the hospital where she tested positive for cocaine, not as an act of judgment on my part, but just as an effort to get at the truth.
Well, the book is about trying to get at the truth. Even the title, The Night of the Gun, you thought that that night your friend Donald wielded a gun, you know, understandably, because you were being such a drag. Come to find out, in talking to him, he was one of the interviews, you had the gun. You had no memory of that.
Well, what I had a memory of is that I was not a gun person, that I was never someone that would wave around a handgun. Only idiots would do that. And I went and saw Donald and told him the story about the day I got fired. We got in this huge fight. I came over and I was being such a jerk that he had to come to the door with a handgun to make me go away. He listened to me 20 years later tell that story and said, yeah, everything about that story is true except you had the gun. And I thought, well, now you've been recklessly sauteing your brain in chemicals and whiskey. Who's to say that you even remember? But a year later, I was talking to someone else, a friend of mine, Chris, who's a professor of creative writing at Loyola, and he talked about moving me out in the dead of night. And he said, yeah, I had to go back in your house and get your gun. And I was like, what? And he said, yeah, 38 special in a box in your closet. And at that point, it started to ring some sort of distant, alarming bells. And there's two gestures of the book. One is, who is a loser? Who is hopeless? 20 years ago, I was on welfare, single parent, on my way to having cancer, chronically addicted, no money. Today, I live in New Jersey. I have a Ford Explorer that runs, a nice dog, 3 lovely children, a wife I adore. And so it's something about how that guy became this guy and how we shouldn't count anybody out. But it's also about the fact that we only really tell stories about ourselves that we abide. I'd like you to think of me as the person in New Jersey with the nice family and the kids, but there's a whole backstory to that.
Let's just pick up a little more of the backstory. You mentioned the twins, Aaron and Megan. Really hard to read these passages, as your friends tell you bluntly, what that home life was like with 2 addicts, 2 little babies, and Anna had 2 other children, 2 and 5. You know, no diapers, no food. You're paranoid looking out the window. You're still, you know, struggling with addiction. There's that point where you go to a crack house to get some stuff and leave these little babies in the car with their snowsuits on. It's so hard to read this. How hard was it for you to go back and honestly write it?
The chronology is when Anna and I were still together and both using, that my sort of Joseph Campbell moment came when I left the kids, parked outside that house, and I came out and resolved never to be that man again, put them in temporary foster care, sobered up, attained custody of them, and raised them, you know, pretty much by myself. I did end up getting married. The reporting of it was a little embarrassing, I would say, to go back to people and say, do you see that huge scab on your shoulder from when you knew me 20 years ago? Do you mind tearing that off. And, oh, by the way, I'm going to videotape you while you do it. But
and write a book about it and talk about it. Write a book about it. Yeah.
The writing of it, not so much. I pretended as if I, not pretended, I acted as if I were writing about someone else. So I tried to be fair and put everything in context.
But it's not, just so embarrassing. I mean, it's embarrassing, but it's also painful because I know what happens. I know that the two girls have grown and are wonderful young women. But in the moment, I'm thinking, somebody pay attention to those kids. You know, you had friends who...
Let's be clear about this. From the time they were 1 year old, I put them first. I was on welfare. I had no money. I earned my way back into civil society. I raised them by myself, even though I had cancer at the time. We lived through Hodgkin's with no other help. There's a heroic aspect to this that, while you find the backstory sort of appalling, there's a lot of uplift here, and it's about, unless I was willing to be straight about where I came from, the things that I did with the help of dozens of people, this village that Hillary Clinton talked about, lifting and pulling. And it's a remarkable human story in that regard. And people tend to focus on the pathology because that's what is most riveting. But there's a slow, organic miracle in the middle of this book that many readers are grabbing onto. And the fundamental message is not about what a bad guy was. It's about the human capacity for change, how people can come together and create something wonderful in their midst. I don't see it as that dark of a book, but in order to tell a true story, I mean, my oldest brother reacted to the book as you did, which is, why are you going to do this? What, you have a really good career, you have a really good reputation. And I just said, if I pull out one stick out of this pile, the whole thing will fall down.
Right.
You have to realize I work at the Culture Department of New York Times, and I've watched many of these memoirs come apart in plain view. And I didn't really want to end up on Oprah getting my arms and legs torn off. So I didn't cut a single corner. And you
and
know
it's
what
not
it is?
Pretty. It's not pretty.
It's not pretty to have out there. But, you know, I think it's a great story. I'm totally proud of it.
Ultimately, it is. There is so much to be proud of. I guess I'm just saying, reading about that first year, you know, with friends staying away, I wanted to tell one of those friends in the book, go get them. Go get the girls out. But people, you and Anna were so toxic that they just stayed away.
Well, I think that many of your listeners could identify with being confronted by pathology that was so towering that they as human beings really didn't know how to respond. Right. That part of the unmanageability of addiction is it puts everybody around it off their axis. There's nothing in the sort of friend handbook that talks about when your friend is a chronic drug addict and has children. Do you call Child Protective Services or not? Do you come and get the kids yourself? What is the right and perfect thing to do?
That's author David Carr. By the way, he writes, God bless Minnesota. They paid for his very long rehabs, gave him food stamps to help him raise his kids when he got them back. And he says, as a citizen with his wheels glued back on, he's paid over $300,000 in taxes to pay him back. We'll have more with David Carr in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from David Carr, who writes about media and business for the New York Times, but now is telling his own story of life as an addict and single father of twin girls. As he writes, his first wife, their mother, just took too long to get off crack. His book is titled The Night of the Gun. A reporter investigates the darkest story of his life, his own. And, David, you married a second woman. You get back into life. Then 13 or 14 years after getting clean, you try social drinking. Now, it didn't work. You drove drunk with those two beautiful daughters, now teens. They didn't really remember you as an addict. It came close to breaking their hearts. What do you say about this idea that alcoholics can drink moderately? There are these new anti-craving vaccines, for instance.
I gave that program a try. I did the additional research into becoming a nice, manageable suburban alcoholic, and it didn't go very well. I believe in the disease concept of addiction. I believe that when I ingest mood-altering chemicals, it has a different effect on me than it would on you, and that the sort of social inhibitions and cognitive solutions to getting someone to cut down on their drinking, for 20 to 30 million Americans, I think that's a total myth and an illusion. The only thing that works is abstinence, support groups, day at a time, all the cliches that other people find so hilarious and happen to be saving the lives of millions every single day.
That's the author David Carr. His new book is The Night of the Gun. A reporter investigates the darkest story of his life, his own. He also, of course, writes his own column for the New York Times. And we want to just end off where we began, asking you about the big, you know, business stories of the day you write on the business pages. And I'm not just asking this because I was looking for a neat and tidy ending. I really am curious. Here we are seeing all, you know, talk about fall from grace, which you write about so eloquently. Huge, you know, absolute tumbles from grace across Wall Street. Is there some sort of, you know, story of possible redemption and forgiveness here already forming, or is that ever going to be possible? Or, you know, just take that part of your story and view that headline.
Well, I do think that in the ashes are the elements of reform. And I do think that it's obviously there's been some overfeeding at the trough. The government is going to have to ask itself about what represents appropriate intervention and how can we maintain a capitalistic system if we remove the consequence when it becomes too severe. In terms of the players themselves, there's nothing in Shakespeare to describe what has happened. These people that we're talking about are the absolute masters of the universe and have lived for years beyond consequence. They find it unbelievable that what they thought could only happen to others has happened to themselves. It certainly is an economic cataclysm, but it is a human tragedy, not just for them, but for the tens of thousands of Wall Street people and the rest of us who are in New York and depend on New York to have that money coursing through. That's gone. So waiters and waitresses, this is the part where trickle-down works, and everybody's going to be feeling it.
But you mentioned intervention, so maybe there is a parallel.
It's not like investors are capable of learning. It's just that the lessons have to be so brutal to get anyone's attention.
David Carr, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure.
Well, let's check in on Wall Street. The insurance giant American International Group, or AIG, saw its stocks drop in worth to near nothing today as the company's credit rating was slashed. The governor of New York has given AIG one day to raise $75 billion. AIG has $1 trillion in assets, 100,000 employees. If it goes belly up, it follows the bankruptcy filing of Lehman Brothers, the forced sale of Merrill Lynch, the biggest drop on the Dow Jones since 9/11. Well, Michael Lewitt is president of the Florida-based money management firm Harsh Capital Management, LLC. Michael, if AIG goes bankrupt, why is it such a big deal?
It's a big deal because AIG is connected to virtually every financial institution in the world. It's active in 130 countries. It is a counterparty to financial transactions worldwide. It's a major investor in the leveraged bank loan market. It is a major investor in the mortgage market, including the subprime mortgage market. It is, of course, a major insurer. There is no part of the financial world that AIG is not a major provider of capital to.
So those companies that handle mortgages and loans and credit are umbilically tied to AIG.
They are. And now AIG will effectively be in liquidation and all of those assets will be for sale. Yesterday, we had $600 billion effectively become for sale with Lehman Brothers. This is now $1.6 trillion of assets that have gone for sale in 3 days from these two institutions.
It's going to be hard just to find buyers. I mean, there's no money to go around.
There are no buyers. There were already no buyers. Okay, there were no buyers before this happened. There are now no buyers, and on top of what was already for sale, you have $1.6 trillion more for sale.
And if it's about to fail, why is it just now getting its ratings so drastically reduced? In other words, ratings companies are saying that it's in trouble.
The reason the rating agencies haven't acted sooner is I think part of it is they were waiting and hoping that AIG would be able to raise capital, and they didn't want to trigger an event sooner.
Well, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson was adamant that he wasn't going to use taxpayer money to bail out Lehman Brothers. We heard about that yesterday. You argued in the New York Times today that the Fed should step in to save AIG. Why?
Because if AIG fails, there's no knowing where this is going to stop. Last week, the federal government stepped in and rescued Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. there was really no point to doing that if they let AIG fail. Because if AIG fails, the system really is going to suffer, I think, immeasurable and unknown harm.
Are we talking 1929?
I don't know if we're talking 1929, but we're certainly talking the worst situation since then. I think that people really can't appreciate the scale of what we're dealing with here. While I certainly wouldn't underestimate the intelligence of those people who are in charge of solving this problem, I just think it's beyond the ken of anybody, because no one in the history of man has ever had to deal with a problem of this magnitude.
Michael Lewitt, president of Harsh Capital Management, LLC, speaking to us from Florida. Well, we will all see together tomorrow. Michael, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, also tomorrow on Here and Now, veterans of the Iraq War are still having trouble getting treatment they believe they need, still being told to prove the shrapnel in their head is from Iraq. What's wrong with this picture? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, warriors from 2,000 years ago. After the news, Here and Now. So, is your investment money safe? If you've got money in a struggling commercial bank such as Washington Mutual or Wachovia, or if you have a brokerage account with bought-out Merrill Lynch or bankrupt Lehman Brothers, or if you have other investments and you don't have a clue where they are, is your money safe? Sandra Block is personal finance reporter for USA Today. And Sandy, you've been asking readers to tell you their concerns. What are those concerns?
Well, they run the gamut from what's going to happen to my Merrill Lynch account, which covers a lot of people because there are millions of people with Merrill Lynch accounts, too. I have money in a bank that I've been reading a lot of bad things about. What happens if the bank goes under? What happens to my insurance policy if it's with AIG? I mean, these issues cover millions and millions of people.
Well, let's get started. Let's say, first of all, you're a shareholder in Lehman Brothers or Merrill Lynch, and your stock has plummeted to next to nothing, and the firm fails, can you get it replaced?
No.
Okay.
No. You can only get your money replaced if you have a brokerage account with the firm and you have securities in other types of companies. Then you can get that money replaced. But if you are a shareholder, if you own stock in Merrill or stock in Lehman, then you're out of luck.
Well, let's talk about these other ways that people can invest in companies. They can buy mutual funds from companies like Fidelity, for instance. Fidelity packages funds, puts them together in groups so individuals can invest, let's say, through their retirement funds at work. And in that way, you may have money in a Lehman Brothers. If the companies that produce those mutual funds go under, are the funds vulnerable? In other words, can debt collectors come and take away the individual investor's money that's in funds?
No, they can't. The legal structure of mutual funds is that the shareholders own the fund. So the fund company has to keep the mutual fund money in a separate custodial account, even if the fund company itself files for bankruptcy and creditors file claims against it. They can't file claims against the assets in the mutual fund. What usually happens, and it's fairly rare for a mutual fund company to go under, but what usually happens is that another mutual fund company buys the mutual fund assets. So actually, mutual funds are a pretty safe place to be right now.
Except that as someone who's invested in a mutual fund, some of your money might be in Lehman Brothers or Merrill Lynch, and it just lost a lot of value.
Yes, that's true, and that's why it's important to check and make sure that you own a diversified mutual fund. For example, if you own Vanguard Total Stock Market Index Fund, only 0.02% of that fund is invested in Lehman Brothers. So even if Lehman Brothers goes to zero, that's going to have a negligible impact on that fund. On the other hand, if you owned a financial services fund, one that invests in banks and financial services industry, then you could potentially have exposure to Lehman, to Merrill, to Wachovia, and then you're going to take a big hit. So that's why it's important to look at the funds that you have and make sure that you don't have too much exposure to any particular company or any sector.
Let's say you do have a brokerage account with a Merrill Lynch. You know, you have a broker there and they're managing your money. Merrill Lynch has been bought out by Bank of America. Or you have a brokerage account at Lehman's, which has just gone bankrupt and is reportedly trying to sell off its brokerage unit. So what happens? Do they contact you? Do you get a new broker? What are you supposed to do?
Well, in the case of Merrill, that's going to be pretty much a non-event, I think, for customers of that firm, because Bank of America says it's going to keep Merrill Lynch name. It doesn't really have any benefit in firing brokers who have good customers. Lehman is a little more complicated because it hasn't found a buyer yet. So we don't really know what's going to happen to those people. But so far, when Lehman filed for bankruptcy, it specifically excluded its brokerage arm that is still operating. So people have accounts with Lehman. Right now, it's business as usual for them as well.
Okay. What if you owe money to either Lehman or Merrill? Let's say you have a Merrill credit card. Does that mean you're off the hook?
I don't think so. No, certainly not in the case of Merrill, because Bank of America wants to continue to collect that money. I don't recollect that Lehman has much in the way of that. Most of their accounts are institutional.
Well, you talked about guarantees. We know the Securities Investor Protection Corps, SIPC, covers investors when a brokerage company fails. But there's also state guarantees. Now, what would the state guarantee?
The state guarantee agencies cover insurance, and that's important to remember right now because of all the problems at AIG. Your own state's insurance guarantee association would cover a certain amount of your losses if your insurance company went out of business. It's fairly rare. I was trying to look this up. It's been a pretty long time since a big insurance company went under. But if that happened, typically you're eligible for up to $300,000 in life insurance death benefits or $300,000 total in benefits if your insurance company just can't pay them anymore.
Well, a question for both the federal and state guarantees. Aren't states and the federal government also invested in funds in the stock market and Wall Street? And is the money going to be there?
Well, that's a good question. I've already been asked that question about the SIPC, and it's certainly a question that comes up with respect to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp, which insures banks, because there has been a big increase in bank failures. But remember that these agencies, their money comes from premiums that they charge the industries that they guarantee, the insurance industries, the securities firms, the banks. So they do have a fairly regular source of money. There is concern that if there are a lot more big failures, that Congress might have to infuse more money into these guarantee agencies. That's certainly a possibility if things get a lot worse.
What if it gets worse? We read that Washington Mutual, the nation's largest saving and loan company, WaMu, is in trouble, Wachovia. We've heard as many as 300 banks might be on a watch list. So what do you expect to happen there?
Well, certainly, I mean, if you talk to the experts, they are predicting more bank failures. We went through a really long period where we didn't have any bank failures at all. We've still only had a handful this year, although the bailout of IndyMac, which is based in California, was a very big one. So that took a big hit on the FDIC's coffers. But the money is still there.
And how much is your bank money insured up to?
$100,000. And it can be more depending on how you structure your accounts. And that's sort of the most important thing for people who are worried about their money to keep in mind, especially bank accounts. Make sure that you don't have uninsured deposits. Because if your deposits are insured, no one has ever lost money from an insured deposit in a bank failure since the FDIC's founding 75 years ago.
Well, so if you're lucky enough to have $100,000, though, it sounds like you're saying don't put more than that in the bank because it may not be insured. But should you put it in the last two brokerage firms standing, Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs?
If you have more than $100,000, there's a lot of other places that you could put it. You could put it in a diversified mutual fund. If you really were very safety conscious, all you'd have to do is put the rest in another bank, because the limit on insured deposits is per bank. So you could have a lot more than $100,000 in insured deposits. You just have to spread it around among several different banks.
Sandy Block, personal finance reporter for USA Today. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Sandy, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, and while you're at our website, remember you can always listen to our program stream live, and you can also download a podcast, take us with you wherever you go as we all together watch the economic news unfold over this week. That's here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. When I first heard we were going to do a segment on a new translation of the ancient Roman epic, the Aeneid, I must say, I heard the sound of flies buzzing against the window pane in a long-ago English class. But then I read it on summer break by the ocean. Red as the Trojan Aeneas sailed the world's oceans, dodging cyclops and sirens, telling the story of the fall of Troy, the Greeks bursting out of that great wooden horse to sack his city, chopping off the head of the old Trojan king after forcing him to watch as they killed his son and then dragged him through his son's blood. Aeneas set off from that sacked Troy with his son and father. His wife is killed, but she appears to him as a shade to tell him his destiny.
In your long exile, you will plow a wide sea, clear to the west, where Tiber's Lydian water sweeps smoothly through the rich fields of warriors. A prosperous kingdom and a royal wife are yours, so weep no longer, though you love me. Farewell. Cherish the child that we created.
So Aeneas loses a wife, but he's going to found the Roman Empire. And now, for the first time in 2,000 years, his epic story has been translated by a woman, poet Sarah Rudin, a visiting scholar at Yale. Sarah, your translation is one of many. So let's start there. What's going on here? Why are there so many translations?
I don't really understand why. There have been so many in very recent years. Some of these translations were conceived or undertaken as American foreign policy has gotten into trouble, as America comes to terms with its own empire. That may well have something to do with it.
Yeah. I want to start with the first line, because people may feel, oh yeah, the Aeneid, I know that first line. I sing of arms and the man. Now, you've been applauded for your clarity, for your modern interpretation, your readability, but you've taken that first line, and instead of the familiar, I sing of arms and the man. You write, arms and a man I sing, the first from Troy. Arms and a man I sing. Why? Why in that direction, right at the outset?
This is the closest that I could get to the Latin. The Latin is arma virumque cano, literally, arms and a man I sing.
And so what was your goal, a literal translation or a lucid translation? Because it is so clear.
Well, I couldn't possibly translate it literally because the word order is quite wacky from an English point of view. So you'd get gibberish if you translated literally.
And instead we have people musing as they might now when he's trying to figure out what had happened to his wife. He says, who knows? We never saw her anymore. I mean, very clear, direct language. What about the fact that you are a female translator? First of all, women don't seem to fare very well in this epic.
No, they don't.
And so what drew you to it?
I have to admit that I wasn't really drawn to it. I was drawn to staying in the translating business. So I needed to undertake a major work.
Well, then what did you find when you got there? If not drawn to it, were you drawn in while, I mean, obviously you had to be drawn in while you were doing it.
I was drawn in very powerfully while I was doing it.
And why?
Well, for me, it has to do with being a Quaker. I'm a pacifist, a Christian pacifist. So it was very odd for me to be translating the Aeneid, which is a poem that in many ways seems to glorify war and nationalism. But I soon got rid of that idea. Virgil's talking about being human and being in society and about everything it costs in every way. He addresses especially how people in society have to put themselves second. They have to repress their passions. This is about being a grown-up and being a full human being, taking full responsibility.
And in Aeneas's case, he's got responsibility for his father, his child, and all the Trojans who are counting on him to get them somewhere where they can found a new country.
Yes, he's got all that's left of a nation in a few ships, and he has to make a very long journey, undergo many dangers, and convince them at the same time that this is worthwhile.
That's Sarah Rudin talking about her new translation of the Aeneid, something college freshmen across the country might be opening even as we speak. By the way, this is the overture from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. More about Dido, the Carthage queen, in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're speaking with Yale visiting scholar and poet Sarah Rudin, the first woman in its 2,000-year history to translate the Roman epic, the Aeneid. Virgil composed the Aeneid toward the end of the 1st century B.C. in Latin, just as Rome was finishing its transformation from a republic to an empire under Caesar Augustus. And after generations of brutal civil war, it was a bit of PR. But Sarah, you've told us that as a Quaker and a Christian pacifist, you were wary about approaching this epic of war and nationalism. But what drew you in was the story of what it cost human beings to live and accomplish things in the world. And yet, there is a lot of slaughter and destruction along the way at the drop of a hat, really.
This is very difficult for me to deal with as a woman. Passion and senseless slaughter, destruction, is often linked to the female.
So, in this book?
In this book, yes.
Well, let's explain, because, for instance, there's the Queen of Carthage, Dido, who falls so in love with Aeneas, who travels with his men through her city, falls so in love, is led to believe by a female god who's manipulating things like a puppeteer from above that, in fact, they are husband and wife, gives herself to him, and then he leaves. And so she impales herself and dies on a funeral pyre. And there's much fighting after that. As I said, women don't stand up well.
No, they don't. They don't stand up well at all. Virgil makes them the representatives of uncontrolled anger, of destructive passion. When Dido is dying, her city is in flames. Before she's breathed her last, Carthage is toppling because of her feelings, because of her love for this man. And then you have Amata later on, the Italian queen, who is possessed by a fury, and her passion is anger. She can't stand for her daughter's marriage to be disrupted.
Because her daughter is destined to marry Aeneas, but she's betrothed and in love with another, and the gods send the fury to make mischief, really, and it's through the women.
It's usually through the women, yes. They are very, very strong personalities. The good woman, the chosen woman in this book is Lavinia, and she doesn't have a single word to say for herself.
No.
She just stands there calmly, you know, with her hair aflame, you know, as an omen of her destiny. That's all she does, and then she bursts into tears in another scene because she can't stand what's going on. Mm-hmm. She's the exemplary woman, and she has no personality whatsoever.
But there's nothing you can do about that because it's not the Aeneid by Virgil and Sarah.
Right. Yes. Yes. And I'm Virgil doesn't disregard them. He doesn't condemn them morally. They are forces of nature, and they're necessary in this story, just as women's point of view is necessary in society. It mm-hmm. gives a counterbalance. The problem, of course, is the violent struggle between the male and female elements.
And the violence struggles between the men. You started to talk about that, how as a Quaker, you know, that's what this is about. And you said this isn't an academic matter. It's immediate. It's primal. One side says, they're taking our stuff. And the other says, well, they're going to kill us. Well, let's kill them first, you know, before they kill us. I mean, it's that direct.
It is that direct, yes. It's that elemental. And we're not talking about something as shallow as nationalism. We're talking about human instincts.
Survival.
And survival, yeah. Yes.
How would you compare and contrast Aeneas and the Aeneid to what's become the stock Western story, the John Wayne figure who is going to strike it out on his own? How would you compare those?
I think you could almost place Aeneas in some kind of transition between ancient and modern Western society. Aeneas is a man with a mission. He's
to found Rome.
Yeah, he's responsible for everything, for the fate of the entire world,
right.
Because Rome is going to take over and pacify the world. And he has to suppress his individual desires, passions. He has to forget about happiness. But unlike a character in the Bible, say Jacob, Aeneas is not getting the definitive answers. The gods are standing off and in many cases saying, you're going to have to figure this out and keep suffering. And how these things work is mysterious.
It's sort of like the original, why do bad things happen to good people?
Yes. Indeed. Yes. Aeneas does everything he's told. Perhaps goes a bit astray with Dido, but doesn't know any better. As a rule, he is almost without fault until his personality begins to deteriorate under pressure from his mission.
He starts to crack, but he also starts to lose some of his virtue. When the Trojans arrive in Italy, they end up causing a civil war there. And the sort of good, noble Aeneas becomes a brutal conqueror. I mean, the book ends with him plunging a sword through the heart of someone that he perhaps didn't have to kill.
Right, yes. Someone who's so dignified, in fact, and such a solid human being that he's not even going to beg for mercy.
The person that he kills. And he has killed also. I mean, it's complicated.
Yes,
they're both
yeah.
warriors. They both
right.
killed. But what does it say? That's where we're left, with a sword plunging through the heart of someone. You know, we know that the result's going to be the Roman Empire, which, by the way, I was smiling. I made a note in my book in the beginning. It's prophesized an empire that will never end. And I wrote next to that in pencil, oh, yeah. But, you know, what are we made to think?
Well, I think Virgil died before he could finish this book. This was not his intended ending. He wanted to go on, and in a canonical length, it would have been twice this length. It would have been 24 books. Yes. So we have a lot to come. And you can think of this in terms of the Roman Civil Wars, in which both sides really went berserk. Then Augustus took over, and things settled down. Even though he had been a full-fledged participant in the civil wars, he managed to back off of rage and revenge to the degree that he could stabilize the Roman state and the Roman Empire. So by the time Virgil was writing this epic, Rome actually had peace. Virgil could see the other end of violent conflict.
And what does it tell us about today?
I spent about 10 years in the New South Africa. So I could add that example to racial conflict in America and to the Iraqi conflict going on now. And I feel a sense of hope. There is no human rage and no human violence that can't be redeemed in the end. Now, I speak as a fellow at Yale Divinity School,
right.
in part.
Wait, is that what Virgil says?
I think that's where Virgil was going.
Yeah.
I think that's why he allowed his hero to reach such depths of dehumanization. And I really don't think he meant to leave him there.
Poet and classical scholar Sarah Rudin, a visiting scholar at Yale, as she said. Yale University Press has just published her new translation of the Aeneid. Sarah, thank you.
You're welcome.